Coming up on the program today, we are going to squeeze just a little bit more out of that Jay Powell interview from yesterday. We'll also have the corporate news of the day. And oh yeah, there's that whole the president goes to Europe thing too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 13th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Not for the first time in the past year and a half-ish or so, we begin this program on a Friday by pointing out that behind the fire hose of political news of the week, there have been economic developments of real import that we would do well to some attention being paid. So we are gonna. Here to do that for us are Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, also Dan Rabone of Yahoo Finance. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Dion, as promised, I'm going to do a little shameless self-promotion here to start the program. Play a piece of tape from my interview with Fed Chairman Jay Powell from yesterday. I want to play one little piece of it, a conversation we had about wages, why they're stuck, and then I have to ask you something about it. So here you go. This is Jay Powell, the chairman of the Fed.
I wouldn't call it a mystery, but I would say that it's a bit of a puzzle given how tight labor markets appear to be. And what we're hearing from employers, really, is that they can't find workers, and you're wondering, well, why aren't wages going up faster?
Why aren't they paying them, right?
It's a good question. Yeah, it's a good question. We don't really have the answer to that question.
So the thing I said to him yesterday in the moment was, that's not entirely comforting that the chairman of the Fed doesn't know the answer to that. How do you feel, as a guy who covers the Fed, about the Fed admitting it kind of doesn't know the answers?
That's a tough one, right?
Welcome to the program.
Thank you, guys. It's good to be here. No, it's not that the Fed is expected to have all the answers. It's just that they're studying all the answers. And the thing that economists and that fund managers particularly have said is that we are right now in an unprecedented economic market. We've never had a situation where we've come off something like QE, quantitative easing, where it was not just one round, but two rounds. You had, you know, the asset purchases, the Fed loading up its balance sheet. And now coming off of that, we have an economy unlike any we've ever really seen before. And all the Fed can really do is study what's happened in the past, but that doesn't really give them clues for a situation that's never existed before. And so this is, you know, it's a bit what you'd expect. I like the way he handled this, where he took you on this sort of roundabout trip, and then you were like, no, but so what do you mean? Right. And he was like, oh yeah, so we actually don't have the answer for that. And that's nice of Chairman Powell, and I think it's part of the way that he's distinguishing himself from former Chair Yellen in that sort of plain speak. But yeah, they don't have the answer, and it shouldn't be that surprising.
Catherine, to that thing about the increased transparency that we've been seeing since Bernanke, right? There was Bernanke and Yellen, and now Powell taking it to another level, really, and this idea of transparency. Do you think he's going to be able to do what he wants to do, which is make people understand the Fed?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think many of us aspire to help the public understand the Fed, which is a very misunderstood institution and a critical institution for making sure that our economy functions properly. And the more understanding and clarity that the public can have about what the Fed does, why its independence is so crucial, I think the better. Hmm. Although on the other hand, like the more attention that's paid to any of those issues in the absence of understanding, the greater risk its independence is. So look, I hope he doesn't draw a lot of attention to the Fed by doing anything crazy or by making a lot of headlines, but to the extent that that he can demystify some of what this very important agency does, I think is a good thing.
As I've shared with Kai, I would love for Chairman Powell to really just get out there and do something crazy. That would be fantastic. It would make my life better.
probably not global markets, though.
Yeah, maybe not better,
not
but more exciting.
Maybe a little crazy. All right. Another piece of tape now, Catherine. This one goes to you. I'm not going to tell you who it is because he's been absent from the scene for a while, which I, for one, find interesting given all that's going on. We're going to play it, and then we're going to talk about who it is and where he's been.
I don't think we're in a trade war. We're in a situation of trade disputes. Okay, these are not trade wars.
Catherine Rampell, name that cabinet officer.
Stephen Mnuchin.
Treasury Secretary, who has been, I personally find him amazingly absent given all that is going on in the global economy and trade. Catherine?
Well, yes, he had been somewhat in the spotlight a couple of months ago when he took a trip to China and led our trade delegation there ostensibly to smooth over the non-trade war, trade dispute,
trade
skirmish,
series of trade disputes,
whatever you want to call it, whatever euphemism you want to use. You know, there had been a lot of press around him then. We have not heard a lot since then, maybe because discussions have fallen apart and because it wasn't super helpful, I guess, to have all of that dirty laundry that was happening in the White House and within that trade delegation itself aired out to the world.
Right. And that was, we should say, that was a congressional hearing yesterday. So Mnuchin honestly popped up yesterday and I was like, we have to play this tape. The thing is, yeah. Dion, you know, he said yesterday talks have broken down. And then the president yesterday, I believe, in Europe was talking more about car tariffs. I mean, there is a long game to play yet in this trade. What are we? Disputes. Yeah.
Yeah, and what's funny about his statement yesterday was he called it a trade war back on May 20th. He said, you know, we're going to put the trade war on hold, using the word trade war, which, you know, as a member of the cabinet, I think it's hard to do accidentally. And we had been going along with this until yesterday when we were told that it wasn't a trade war. And this seems to not just be a war with China, but a war with the rest of the world, trying to kind of redraw these lines of trade in America's favor. And this would be the sort of thing that would be really nice to go at with some allies. Mm-hmm. And it seems like this administration is hell-bent on ensuring that we have no allies and we go at this completely alone.
And on the other hand, that China is trying to marshal our once allies to its side.
Right,
and
right.
The Chinese Ministry of Commerce released a statement today, even saying basically as much.
That sure, it would be nice to have a partnership, maybe across the Pacific right now.
If only there was a thing called TPP. All right, we got to go, you guys. Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post, Dion Rabone at Yahoo Finance. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you, Guy.
All right, you guys, have a nice weekend. And I'll tell you what, just to double down on that shameless self-promotion thing, we put the whole interview I did with Fed Chair Jay Powell in our Marketplace podcast feed. You can get it there. It's also on our webpage, marketplace.org. The whole half hour is there. On Wall Street this Friday, the 13th, a little choppy, a little bouncy. The major indices finish real close to level. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Earnings for some of the biggest banks in the country came out this morning. JPMorgan Chase, Citigroup, PNC Financial by name. Quite healthy profits all the way around, really. Could have been better, though, were it not for the American Housing Market Mortgage Refinancing Department. Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports on why and what it's going to mean.
Since 2009, Mike Frattantoni and his partner have refinanced their home three times.
We'd managed to lock something in close to the low point and don't expect to refinance again.
Millions of other homeowners are in the same boat, says Frattantoni. And he would know. He's chief economist with Mortgage Bankers Association.
Today, we are at the lowest level of refinance activity since December 2000.
An 18-year low because of a little thing known as mortgage rates. They're up 0.75 percentage point since last year.
And that's big.
Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate and finance at Wharton. She says for banks,
this is a profit stream that's a ready source of cash when the climate is right, when rates are falling. And it just simply isn't now.
Yes, banks are hurt by lower levels of refinancing. But, says Aaron Davis, a credit analyst at Morningstar,
because they have so many other kinds of lending businesses and maybe even non-lending businesses, the impact on their bottom line is usually pretty muted.
Davis says over the years, more of the mortgage business has gone toward newer lenders like Rocket Mortgage, which don't have as many revenue streams as big banks. So,
in a way, it's a little worse for the non-bank lenders right now than the banks.
She says smaller lenders have been cutting back staff. Refinancing levels dropped by almost 40% last year, and analysts expect more or less the same thing this year. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
As I mentioned right at the end of the program yesterday, the Department of Justice is sticking to its antitrust guns in the AT&T-Time Warner merger case. DOJ is appealing the ruling from a month or so ago that cleared the way for the roughly $85 billion deal between the telecommunication and content giants. With the observation that the deal has already been done, paper signed, money transfer, the whole smash, and the two companies are already in the process of merging, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports from Washington on what happens now.
The Department of Justice is well within the time limit to appeal the decision. It's been barely a month since a federal judge ruled in AT&T's favor. But a lot can happen in a month.
The process internally of consummating this merger is well underway.
Ryan Radia is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I spoke with him on Skype.
We've seen Time Warner rebranded as Warner Media. Employees are hearing from new leadership about how properties such as HBO will do business going forward.
So what happens now? That's up to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, says Barack Richman at Duke University Law.
What tends to happen is that the appellate court issues a temporary injunction and asks the parties to stop pursuing the merger until the review is complete.
But putting things on hold at this point will be disruptive and expensive, says Richman, especially when you're talking about companies as big and complex as AT&T and Time Warner. And if the court ultimately decides to stop the merger, the companies would
have to unscramble the eggs, they say. And that's fairly unusual because it's so difficult to unscramble the eggs.
And AT&T and Time Warner aren't the only companies with something at stake. The initial decision gave other companies confidence that their mergers would work out, too. Witness the Comcast-Disney bidding war over Fox. Nanette Heide works on mergers and acquisitions at the law firm Duane Morris.
So it's not a clear pathway to those deals getting done, which is what everyone thought would be the case once the AT&T Time Warner decision came out.
Everyone may have been wrong. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
AT&T and Time Warner and the Justice Department appeal are the media news of the moment, yes. But as Kimberly was saying right there in her piece, there is another bidding war, takeover battle, whatever you want to call it, brewing out there, that is a big deal. Disney and Comcast have been beating each other up over the past couple of months, trying to get their hands on the entertainment parts of Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox. It looks at the moment like Disney's got the upper hand. Shareholders are going to vote on the company's $71 billion offer at the end of the month. And one key asset in all of this is Hulu, which is interesting because Disney, Comcast, and Fox each already own a 30% stake in the streaming service. Obviously, the winner, though, gets majority control. Ashley Milne-Tite explains why Hulu is such a prize.
Hulu started out a decade ago, streaming TV shows made by its corporate owners. People weren't sure it would last, but the site now has 20 million subscribers. That reach is a plus for any new overlord, says Mark Robichaux, Managing Director of Content at Multichannel News.
What all of these players are seeing is it is a tremendous challenge to build an audience from scratch.
He says Hulu has done that.
And that's why this is such a valuable prize.
Hulu doesn't just let viewers watch shows they missed the night before or revisit old favorites like Law & Order and ER.
It's making its strides in original programming, which is always a first step to maturity.
Rebecca Lieb tracks digital marketing and media at Kaleido Insights.
You know, The Handmaid's Tale was the winner of a great deal of critical acclaim last year.
Hulu's adaptation of Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel won an Emmy for Best Drama in 2017.
I had another name, but it's forbidden now. So many things are forbidden now.
The second season debuted in April, and the company keeps pushing on original content, helped by the $1 billion in ad revenue it brought in last year. Ron Simon follows the changing TV landscape at the Paley Center for Media. He says to make its new thriller Castle Rock, Hulu worked with Hollywood producer J.J. Abrams and horror author Stephen King.
That proves that they certainly can outbid any network or technology to get the most interesting new concepts.
Rebecca Lieb says Hulu may be a relative pipsqueak compared to rivals Netflix and Amazon Prime. Netflix has six times as many subscribers. But she says just as in the past, three broadcast networks dominated the airwaves.
I predict that in the future, we're going to have three streaming services going head-to-head, Amazon, Netflix, and Hulu.
But Mark Robichaux sounds a note of caution. He says, yes, this is a golden age for quality TV. But who can watch it all? Last year, almost 500 scripted shows aired on broadcast, cable, and streaming networks. That's more than double the number in 2010. Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu are spending billions of dollars to make these programs. He says many media watchers are asking,
with big streaming giants coming in, paying double, triple, quadruple the amount paid by legacy players, and everybody spending more money, are we in a content bubble? And if so, when does that bubble pop?
But for now, media companies are betting consumers' appetite for well-produced shows won't be sated anytime soon. and that even if they can't consume all that content, they'll keep sampling from the menu while paying for the privilege. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you have to wonder exactly who's running the show.
Yes, you do, because whoever's running it, that Brexit show is a mess. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 94 points on this Friday, the 13th, 0.3%, 25,019 at the end of the day. NASDAQ up 2 points, barely changed, 78.25. S&P 500 gained 3 points, about a 10%, 28.01. There for the week, the 5 days gone by, the Dow added 2.3%, the NASDAQ gained 1.7%, the S&P 500 1.5% to the good for the week. Johnson & Johnson gave back 1.4% today. The consumer goods giant was ordered to pay more than $4 billion, to 22 women who alleged its talc-based products caused cancer. McDonald's down 0.3%. Fast food chain is being investigated by health department in Iowa and Illinois over infections linked to salad at its restaurants. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. One of the defining characteristics of this economy the past generation or two has been a sharp rise in income inequality, sometimes called the wealth gap, the economic difference between people at the top of the income scale and the people at the bottom. The Pew Research Center is out with some new analysis this week of the data they have on this, income inequality broken down by race and ethnicity. Marketplace Mitchell Hartman reports on what they found.
First, let's define the economic terms. The most common income inequality measure looks at the gap between income for the top 10% of earners and those in the bottom 10%. The Pew Research Center has been looking at that gap within major ethnic and racial groups in America. Back in 1970, African Americans had the biggest income gap.
We find that today inequality is greatest among Asians.
Rakesh Kocher is senior researcher at Pew.
This is the result of a near doubling in income inequality among Asians from 1970 to 2016.
Kocher says what's happened is that the Asian population in America has increased dramatically, driven mostly by immigration. Many come for high-tech or entrepreneurial jobs and start earning good salaries right away, most notably immigrants from India.
They are among the best educated. About three-quarters have at least a college degree or some higher level of education.
But there are also very poor Asian immigrants, refugees, poor relatives joining family here. So a lot of high earners and low earners, too. Vivek Wadhwa is a tech entrepreneur and research fellow at Harvard Law School.
The people who have low skills, they're left out, disadvantaged, and we have to help these people.
The highest earning Asians in the U.S. now make almost 11 times more than those at the bottom. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
President Trump had tea with the Queen today. It was almost certainly the calmest moment so far of his European trip. NATO, and then that interview he gave right before dinner with British Prime Minister Theresa May. She, by the way, has been having a plenty rough enough time even before the president came to town. May came out with her Brexit plan last week and promptly lost three ministers from her government and two other senior officials who, along with other hard Brexiters, say that what May wants keeps the UK too close to the European Union, what is known as a soft Brexit. But then along comes the president of the United States, a vocal supporter of Britain making a clean, hard break with the European Union. But also the president is key to May's post-Brexit economic plans. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Anti-Trump protesters inflate the so-called Trump baby, a 20-foot-high balloon in the shape of a huge, orange, angry toddler. They floated it over London today to the annoyance of some Trump supporters here.
It's embarrassing for the people protesting. I mean, that balloon's ridiculous.
Drew Lickerman of Republicans Overseas says the protesters are insulting the one man who can really help Britain make a success of Brexit.
You have the UK leaving the European Union. You have these people that want to shun the US. Who do you want to work with? You want to work with China, Iran? I mean, it's just quite pathetic, I think.
Many hardline Brexit supporters agree, and they're unhappy with Theresa May's Brexit plan, which the Prime Minister unveiled last week.
This is a proposal that I believe will be good for the UK and good for the EU, and I look forward to it being received positively.
It wasn't by many Brexiteers. They say the plan would keep Britain shackled permanently to EU regulations and prevent it from striking free trade deals with countries like the US. John Longworth is with the hardline group Leave Means Leave.
It's much less likely that we will get a good trade deal or any trade deal with the United States if the current proposal that has been put forward by the Prime Minister persists.
She's bungled the negotiation, he says. Britain would be better off if Trump had been handling Brexit. He's not the only one to say that. Just listen to this covert recording of a senior figure in May's own party. It was posted on the BuzzFeed website.
How would Donald Trump have approached our Brexit negotiations?
That's Boris Johnson, May's former foreign secretary, who resigned this week over her plan. He was recorded privately lauding Trump's negotiating skills. Even veteran financial columnist Matthew Lynn, no fan of the American president, says May could learn something from Trump's hardline approach.
Look at his what he's been doing of Europe, for example, on cars.
Lynn says when Trump threatened to slap a big tariff on European autos, German Chancellor Angela Merkel then talked about the EU lowering tariffs on American cars. Lynn says since the UK is one of the biggest export markets for German vehicles, Theresa May should get tough like Trump.
She could be as threatening as Trump. So she could say, well, we're going to have a 50% tariff on German cars. Why not? Once you come out of the EU, that's possible.
Many trade experts insist that Trump's approach will not pay off. If there's a global trade war, it could cost everyone in the end. But the issue of May's leadership abilities remains. A military band serenaded the president as he arrived on Thursday night for a banquet with May at Blenheim Palace, birthplace of one of his personal heroes, Winston Churchill.
I think it's a great choice of venue because, of course, Winston Churchill was one of our great leaders and prime ministers.
Brexiteer John Longworth says Churchill's unabashed pursuit of British interests contrasts starkly with what he considers May's timidity.
Our prime minister actually went to see the Chancellor of Germany the day before she presented to her own cabinet the document that she's putting forward to the European Union, to ask for permission. You have to wonder exactly who's running the show.
Churchill would be turning in his grave.
Churchill would be spinning in his grave.
Tens of thousands of anti-Trump protesters were out in force in central London today. Opinion polls indicate that around 50% of the Brits are unhappy about the visit. You have to wonder whether that might include Prime Minister May, who was reported to be furious about Trump's call for a bolder Brexit. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, irony thy name is trying to do the right thing. Twitter the past couple of days has been getting serious about getting rid of fake accounts. Tens of millions of them have been deleted from the service. It's a good thing, cutting out the bots and the malicious accounts and all that. The inevitable result, though, of course, is that real Twitter users are losing followers, including yours truly. The biggest loser, though, Twitter itself. The at Twitter handle lost 7.5 million followers, basically overnight. That's a bit more than 12% of its total. President Obama down about 2.25%. President Trump about 0.5% off. The New York Times did the math. Credit where credit's due. But lest you think follower counts are overblown, first of all, they are, and you're completely right. But also, they're real, right? They're currency in this social media influencer economy in which we live. Speaking of which, just, you know, because, and also to complete the shameless self-promotion trifecta on the program today, it's at KAIRYSSDAL on Twitter. The show is at Marketplace. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 94 points today, 0.3%. NASDAQ basically flat. S&P 500 up 3. That's 0.1% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. The executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.